Thank you for staying. So I'm going to introduce Ritu and say a little bit about her, and then I'll introduce myself a little bit and say a bit about myself as well. And then I will ask a couple of questions, and then I'm going to open it up to you. So any questions or comments that you have, either about the content, you know, the subject matter of the piece, or, you know, the creative process of the piece, anything that comes to mind is fine. We have about 45 minutes. I will just say that we're filming the panel, and as you see, I'm recording sound on it. That's partly for Adishakti's archive, but also because we sometimes share some of the snippets from these conversations, because it can be really useful for people to hear what's been going on in these conversations. But what we'll never do is film any of you, or also take sound recordings of any of you and your voices. So anything that's said here is anonymous, and it's a safe space, and I would ask you to respect that for other people as well. If people share anything, then, you know, don't share beyond this room, obviously. So yeah, I'll introduce Ritu and then speak about myself, and then we'll get into a conversation. So Ritu Tyagi is assistant professor at Pondicherry University. She completed her doctorate from Louisiana State University in the USA. She's published numerous articles on Francophone literature, post-colonial and feminist writing. Her book, Ananda Devi, Narration, Polyphony and Feminism, was published with Rodopi in 2013 and was well received by critics. Myself, beyond the work I do as a theatre maker, and actually through the process of making this play, I've become an activist and campaigner in the UK for issues surrounding sexual violence and sexual assault. I work for two organisations primarily, one of which is called the Consent Collective, and we take performances, workshops and panels into universities and big businesses to open up conversations around sex, pleasure, sexual violence and consent. And there's another organisation called On Road Media, which brings survivors together with journalists in order to enable a more nuanced conversation around sexual violence through the media. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I also want to mention at this point, it may be obvious to you, but that all of the voices that you've heard in the play are the actual voices of people who are telling their own stories. So it's a testimonial piece, and all of those voices are the real people. So my voice makes up the thread which winds through the play, and the male voice that you hear is the perpetrator of one of my assaults. I had a kind of reconciliation process with him, and through that he agreed to be interviewed for the play. And of course all of the other voices as well are those who are sharing their own stories. So, Ritu, I just wanted to open up by asking for a response to the play within the context of the local environment for women and sexual violence here.
Well, I would begin by congratulating you, thanking you first for inviting me so that I have this opportunity to actually be in person and congratulate you for this incredible and very, very powerful piece. I had this opportunity to see here, and perhaps on behalf of the audience as well. So a big congratulations to you for this great effort. As I was driving here and I was discussing with a friend of mine, we were talking about this play, and we were really amazed at the fact that somebody would have so much courage. It requires a lot of courage. Perhaps you would have felt that, you know, initially in your initial years when you started, or when you started actually thinking about the idea of putting your stories into place. So I would like to acknowledge the fact that, you know, you had that courage, and congratulate you for having that courage, because it might have been, I do not know how that process was, perhaps somebody would ask that question later and you would, you know, elaborate on it, but I believe that it would have been you know, some sort of a process. You would have processed the you know, issues that you went through, and then you would have come to a point where you would have said that, okay, now I am willing to bring my stories out for the consumption, if I could say, of the other people, and also so that those stories could be in that's what you do later, because your voice then becomes, you know, the thread that goes through the other voices, even including the voice of the perpetrator, which I find is very interesting. So one of the, I mean, looking at the piece of theatre, I'm not an artist, a theatre artist, so as a literary critic, I would say that I'm really impressed by, you know, the fact that you bring the voiceover and the physical act together. And in doing that, you sort of transgress the boundaries of theater, dance, and many of those things. And, you know, you give a possibility of thinking out of the box in certain ways, which allows you to do a lot of things at the same time, which allows you to bring your own story along with other stories, because you have this, you know, mixed genre that allows you to bring the other voices into your own voice, as well the voice of the perpetrator. The other thing that I was particularly impressed was the fact and the ability to go to a point where you were actually think of bringing the perpetrator's voice into the play, because I've read so much, you know, from the perspective of feminist theory, from the perspective of literature, I have been dealing with so many stories, and the stories usually are preoccupied with telling the tale of what happened. I mean, that itself requires a lot of courage and a lot of processing of the event and a lot of other things. But taking it to a point where one would think of going past that story, the thinking of a process of healing, to a point where the healing brings the perpetrator, who one tends to see as a victim or a survivor, as the other. You know, many have pointed out that it's a tremendously difficult process to see the perpetrator as a normal person. So to bring that voice itself within the play, that's a great point to begin. It's a great place, great platform to begin to think of, you know, thinking of the perpetrator as not a person who is completely the other, but as a voice that needs to be heard, addressed, in order to understand the what you call the culture of sexual harassment on a bigger, on a structural front. So in that sense, I would really congratulate you for having that idea of bringing that other and giving us the notion that it is important for us to see the survivor and at the same time look at the perpetrator who committed the crime and what led the perpetrator to commit the crime in the first place, to be able to understand this whole culture of, you know, sexual assault or rape.
Yeah.
So on a bigger level, it is important. The perpetrator is as important as the survivor on a certain level. So those are some of the comments that I have.
So I might just respond to a couple of them first before I ask you to move on to talking about the local context, if that's all right, because I think there are some, as you say, some points which are interesting brought up. So the first one being about the process of making it and what you describe as courage. And I think it's important to say that for me, it was a process of many years processing my own history. And gradually then, when I felt safe enough to, as you say, taking small steps towards building this piece, and I built it very gradually over a period of time. First of all, it was just my voice, and then it was my voice and his voice, and then it was my voice and his voice and two other survivors, and then they seemed quite polarized in terms of the spectrum of different assaults which can happen, so I felt it was important to fill in that spectrum with all those other voices. But all the way along, and I think really the main reason it took so long to build this was because I had to make sure that I was safe. I had to make sure that this wasn't theatre as therapy, that I wasn't using this space to process my shit, because actually that wouldn't be safe for the audience and it wouldn't necessarily be very effective either. So I had to make sure that I was doing that work outside the room, and that's why it took me at least a couple of years to build the piece. To quote Madeline, who's the voice that you hear in the middle, she speaks out publicly, she's written a novel, she's a brilliant speaker. When I'm kind of raging around the chair and she talks about being violently gang raped by two teenagers when she was a teenager herself, when she was a child herself. One of the things that she said is that I share my stories for those who haven't yet found their voices. And in my context as well, I think for people who aren't able to, you know, because it's not okay for many people to speak about this stuff. So for me, it's very much about that, about sharing the story so that everybody else doesn't have to, you know, because my feeling is that we have to talk about this stuff in order to be able to move on, obviously. The other thing that I wanted to say in regards to what you said was about the perpetrator voice, and yeah, it was, I think I was, it seems inappropriate almost to say this within this context, but I feel very fortunate that he was able to take responsibility enough for us to have that conversation. Because that for me was like handing back the shame, the humiliation, the responsibility to him, where it belonged, because it doesn't belong with the survivor, but so often we're the ones that are carrying it. So it felt great that I could hand that back.
Yeah, and the healing could happen.
Exactly. That was definitely a huge part of the healing process for me. But also the fact that he took responsibility, because I didn't know before having this conversation, of course, whether or not he was going to, you know, admit to what happened. I didn't know what his response was going to be. And then that he agreed to speak in the show, you know, to be recorded, because I think it's very important, you know, partly to hand over the burden of the conversation, but also partly so that we can recognize, as you say, that this is a normal voice. These voice, you know, for every assault, there's a perpetrator. And these people are people who move among us. They are not, as you know, as I know it's always painted in the media in the UK and Europe and America, there's some evil outliers to society lurking down an alley waiting for. So they're not that. They are our family members, they are our colleagues, they are our partners, friends. We have to recognize that they're normal people too. And I think he sounds like a normal person because he is, you know, he's a professional. He's going about his life, and those are the kinds of people that do this, and that's one of the reasons I found it so important to bring that voice in. Yeah. So then, can you talk about the context locally and how this story kind of relates to what your experience is of the local context for women?
Going back to the perpetrator, before I begin with the local context and start sharing my own story, It's really, I mean, it sounds nice to say that, you know, you have to look at the other, the perpetrator as well, and incorporate the perpetrator. And as you mentioned, it really helps to have the perpetrator, partially because you undergo a process of dehumanization as that person, you know, one of the survivors narrated the incident that she was urinated upon and how helpless. That I believe is the first emotion when something like that happens. The first emotion is that of absolute helplessness. Mm-hmm. And at some other point in life when you get certain kind of recognition from the same person, you know, there is that, it helps in the process of healing or helps going past that process of dehumanization. But it is very, very complicated. In your case, you know, the perpetrator was somebody known to you and somebody who, you know, perhaps made a bad decision at a wrong time, not necessarily a person who, you know, goes on raping people day and night. And could happen, but then within different contexts it gets very, very complicated, and I'll talk about that when I discuss the local. Mm-hmm. I'll begin with my own story. I have never had like a major, not that I can recall, any major, you know, kind of trauma.
Yeah.
Having said that, I was really intrigued by the way you were carrying the chair initially at the beginning of the play, and then towards the end you were, you know, nicely placed, stable, and sitting within the chair. So I'll go back to those two images to be able to narrate my story. And I would say that I have been carrying that chair too, without having undergone any massive or even minor sense of sexual assault. I have been marked by a sense of sexual violence throughout my life without having undergone any of these things that you talk about in this play. And how did that happen? How have I been carrying that chair and still struggling to sit into it now?
Yeah.
That is my story. From childhood, I mean, at home I could see, and that will give you an idea of, you know, the Indian, certain Indian context, because when one talks about, if by local you mean Indian, then one has to look at the complexities of what constitutes India. And then that question leads us into the whole gamut of issues related to class, caste, and all the power equations, because sexual violence is something that is, you know, intricately related to notions of power.
Yeah.
It's more related to power than with sexual gratification. Many a times I wonder, I mean, when you're so stressed out and you're actually penetrating someone, is there any sense of joy that you could, you know, feel? I mean, I really cannot fathom, I cannot imagine somebody feeling a sense of joy. So I believe mostly that it is more of power, less of sexual gratification. And that brings us to the complexities of Indian society, where you have this whole notion of caste and class and all the other notions that, if you want, you know, I can open up those chapters little by little. And perhaps, you know, others would also be would be knowing more as activists than I do, because I've explored most of these things as a literary critic. But to talk about a certain sense of fear and a sexual violence that is always around me, I would narrate my story as a young girl who was, you know, I could see the discrimination happening at home, not within the nuclear family. My parents were very liberal about things. But when I would go to my grandparents' house, I knew that, you know, I was discriminated, as in I was asked to do things that my, you know, cousins, male cousins, were never asked to do. And that really upset me. And I would, you know, have fights over that. And others would just think of me as a quite aggressive person. So that was one part of the story. And then as I was growing up, I could see that, you know, I grew up in northern India, in Delhi and NCR. And by now, I think the whole world knows that because of the Nirbhaya case that you're perhaps aware of, that it is supposedly the, you know, most talked about region where you can feel the sexual violence in the air. So I grew up with that. And I was fed with that fear through my parents, my mother particularly, who would, you know, when I was a kid, I think 4 years old, I used to think that I was a boy and I would really wear, you know, male clothes and go around and, you know, give myself male names, and I would, you know, and it was fine. But this started changing as I grew up, 5 years, 6 years, and then my mother started feeding me. I had all male friends because my cousin was there, male cousin, and he had all the friends who were my friends. So I would go out and play with them, and I would really use abusive words that my male friends would use. And my mother was really upset about the fact that I was using those abusive words, because as a girl, I was not supposed to use those abusive words. Not that I'm proud of it. I still use some of those now. Which is very problematic, because most of the abusive words are, it's a paradoxical situation, are against women. And as a feminist, I'm not supposed to, but then, you know, I've internalized them somehow. And then there is the other part of it, that as women, you're not supposed to use the abusive words. So it's important for me, you know, to assert my aggressiveness. I have to use, and there have been contexts where I have used them to my benefit. So going on with my story, gradually my mother made me feel bad about the fact that I consider myself to be a boy and that I have to think of myself as a girl, etc. And that's somehow sorted out in a way that I developed sort of, you know, inherent fear towards men. During my school days, I went to a co-educational institute and I had great relationship with men, but I gradually realized that when men started coming closer to me and started entering into intimate domains, I had, you know, the urge to push them back. As a result, during my college days, I ended up being a very, very frigid person. And one of the incidents that I remember clearly is that I was just driving a bicycle on my way back from school to home, and it was raining, so the street was deserted, and there were two boys who came and they just touched my boobs, and they were on a motorbike and they just rode past me. There was absolutely no way I could, you know, do anything. And I distinctly remember, it was like 30 years back, distinctly remember the feeling of absolute helplessness to begin with, lot of rage after that, And then all those years of dealing with it, I'm still dealing with it because I actually couldn't do anything about it. I don't even know who they were. So how do I go to them? How do I process this? How do I respond to this? Where do I put it in my memory? I mean, it is still there. So that was that. And then going to my college life, I had these beautiful male friends around me who would question, you know, the fact that I am incapable of entering into any intimate relationship. And then it so happened, thanks to numerous interesting, very nice people, males, who came into my life and who stayed with me for some time, told me that I was very frigid, and then moved on, thankfully for them. And then perhaps one or two ended up, you know, working with me, processing my rage that had, you know, turned into frigidity. I mean, imagine all those valuable years that I could not experience my own sensuality. And such a waste. And then I came to a point, you know, thanks to a lot of interesting males who, I mean, there are all kinds of people around. And going back to the stories, most of the stories that you brought to the platform are the stories where, you know the perpetrator and he's somebody who is drunk and who happened to, somebody who knows you and who happened to, you know, derive advantage of the moment. I have been in a similar circumstance where I had been with somebody and we were completely drunk and we were just friends, and then he proposed a one-night stand, and I said that I'm a frigid person anyway. I mean, I don't know whether we can, you know, go to any, I mean, whether it's going to be in your advantage too. And he said, let's try. And I said, okay, if you're, I mean, I didn't know how stupid I was to have told him yes. So we started the act, and at one point I thought that I was not enjoying it, and what's the point? So I asked him to stop, and he stopped. He stopped. I mean, I had been blessed to have such people around me that he stopped.
Yeah. And I really feel like that's the way that consent should work, right? Yeah. Do you want to do this thing? Not really. Oh, it might be fun. Yeah, okay. Like, that's, you know, because I think it's important to kind of talk about the coercion culture in which we live. And that's been mentioned a lot in these panels, actually, these conversations we've been having, where people are saying, you know, in Hindi cinema, in Bollywood, so much of the time it's about the man pursuing and pursuing and pursuing and pursuing. And actually, like, that gets to a situation of coercion and also of harassment. And then the woman is supposed to eventually comply. But that, you know, to have, as you say, to have someone who, when you say, actually, I'm not enjoying it, okay, great, fine, I will leave it there. And not to, you know, doing all that pressuring. And it makes me think of the idea of affirmative consent as well, where instead of, you know, someone having to say no for you to know that it's assault, switch it around and say, you know, you need to have someone say yes.
Yes.
And say, I want to do this. So yes. Affirmative consent rather than the its opposite seems to me a much more helpful way.
Can I add something to it? I think it has a lot to do with how we understand sex within the different cultures, and perhaps it might be slightly different between India and the Western world, but how we tend to understand sex. Is it, pursuing someone who ends up giving in to you, or is it looking for consensus? Like, I've known people who even at the slightest hint that I'm not interested in pursuing the act with them have abandoned me, because it was important for them to have, you know, the reciprocal feeling, and that what I believe is should sex be, you know, it has to hinge itself on that notion of reciprocity, which, you know, then leads us to the notion of equality in a certain way. And one has to then, you know, look at some of the older ancient texts, Indian texts, to understand how, you know, sexual relationships were perceived as. And in certain mythological texts, it has been taken as something sacred. Sacred in the sense, I mean, that's how I interpret it. Sacred in the sense of reciprocity. It is important for you to feel that the other one wants you, you know, for you to make that advance. So I believe that it has to go back to our notions, how we have how those notions of sex and sexuality have evolved through time and where they stand today.
Yeah.
And they stand today at a very problematic juncture where violence has become a very integral part of sex.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, how did we reach there? That is one of the important questions that, you know.
Yeah.
And talking about the complexities of the Indian scenario, I would say that, you know, I mean, taking, for example, the caste issue into consideration, I mean, as I had been carrying that chair throughout my life, I mean, I would point out to the fact that sexual violence has been normalized to a dangerous extent in India, to the extent that when it comes to talking about the lowest of the classes or lowest of the castes, these are the women who are employed by, you know, the high caste people. And sexual abuse, sexual assault is something that is completely normalized for the perpetrator as well as for the victim. I mean, there are no stories to be narrated. And that is where I believe your play has, you know, it has to contribute a lot. It has to reach, you know, to the audience in such a way, it has to touch them in such a way that it brings out the stories, because when it is normalized, it is difficult to get those stories to the platform.
Yeah, definitely.
And as a literary critique, I believe that story has the power of, you know, bringing other stories onto the platform.
Yeah, definitely.
It has that, it has some magical power to draw out your own experience. When you listen to somebody else's experience, you know, somehow that reciprocity somehow enters into the play, and you know, you have to be, you come out with your own story that had been, you know, buried inside.
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of my reasons for making the piece. And also, it was the way in which, and this I hope is kind of demonstrated through the play, that's the way I came up with my story, was by hearing other people's stories and going, oh, actually, something like that has happened to me, and therefore being able to recognize it. Which is one of the other reasons I think it's so important that we do talk about it, because when we share our stories, it helps other people to understand. When we share certain kinds of language, it helps us to understand. You know, without the vocabulary to describe a particular kind of assault, we can't necessarily recognize it. And that was definitely the case for me. So I think we can open it up. So any comments or questions? Yes.
Yeah, one thing she mentioned was that, you know, without even facing any major assault, she felt violated. She was like carrying a burden. So in some ways, is it the idea of a woman and the idea of a man, not looking at as a biological sex, the idea of a woman is generally that, you know, she takes responsibility for anything wrong that's happening. Now, the idea of a man is, you know, slightly combative, more combative, like buck up boy types, you know. So because women and men react differently to assault. Like I have faced assault as a child. But yet, I was never carrying a burden so far like this. I mean, because it's like the boys are always told, like, you know, buck up, you know, you don't feel bad about that. So the idea of a male somehow helps guys process assault more easily. You don't carry around the burden. Now the idea of a woman places the burden upon themselves. So I feel that's where.
I think it has something to do with this overarching idea of being ashamed about your body, you know, that you talk about in your play. That you have to be ashamed, you have to be pleasing, you have to be this nice person who doesn't create trouble, because everything about you can create trouble. So I think it has to do with that notion of shaming that gets internalized in a brutal manner within the within the psyche, within the female psyche. I wouldn't say Indian psyche, I mean, all over the world. I think it has to do with that.
Next thing that we're going to come up is one of the solutions that you need to desexualize activities, you know, or you desensitize the very idea of chastity. You know, there's so much hype around the very idea of chastity that it's given so much hype that the woman feels violated if something goes wrong with that. Why
I think
we desensitize that a bit, because that's how men perceive themselves. Like somebody who's touched me inappropriately, how do you feel violated? I mean, I can talk that from a personal experience.
Yeah, I think I think we have to be quite careful here about the kind of gender divide. in my activism at home, and I take responsibility for this because I was talking about men and women as if, you know, perpetrators and victims, but of course it can be the other way around. And of course men can be victims and very often are also victims of sexual violence as well. And I would be hesitant to suggest that for all men, any form of assault is less traumatizing than it is for any women. I would be very, in my personal experience, men that I work with who are survivors haven't had it any easier than female survivors. So maybe it depends on the extent of the assault, maybe it depends on the individual. And I think every survivor will respond to any kind of assault in a different way. And we have to find our own ways of processing them for that reason, but also, I mean, it's interesting what you say, this, the idea of chastity. Yes, it is, you know, held up so high for women that there's not only the trauma that exists in our body and our psyche as a result of trauma, but there's also that kind of public shame, obviously, which exists as well, which is layered onto it. But I think, I think it can be different for different people. We're all individual in the way. Sorry, I'm just going to move on because there's lots of people here, and it was great to have an individual conversation, but I also want to bring in other voices in this space as well. Yeah.
Thank you very much. This was wonderful.
Thank you.
And is part of your secondary or tertiary role, I don't know, I mean, one is to have the conversation. But does that also lead to the legals, and to what degree has this worked in terms of the legal system shifting or changing and looking at the perpetrator and looking down the road at what's happening? Mm. So that's a two-part question.
Yeah.
And the second part, if in fact it has been something, has that been able to go around to other countries?
Right, well, that's some big questions. And I mean, as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any change in any law or legality as a result of this piece,
yet.
Or as a result yet, or as a result of any of the other campaigns that I'm part of. The Consent Collective that I mentioned earlier is run by a very brilliant woman called Dr. Nina Burrows, and she not only runs the Consent Collective, but she also trains people within the criminal justice system, and she trains policemen, and she trains lawmakers in sexual violence. And one of the things that she's pushing to change in the UK is that sexual violence cases are tried like any other cases with a jury. But so often we carry these preconceptions and these prejudices around sexual violence, and she believes it's one of the reasons that we don't secure enough prosecutions in sexual violence cases. So she's trying to remove the jury and have, or if anything, have expert jurors and expert witnesses who understand better, you know, because there's this whole thing of, what did the, you know, did the survivor look enough like a survivor? Did she cry enough? Did she cry too much? Like, oh, probably she's not that traumatized. You know, there are so many layers of prejudice that we hold around this stuff. That's a huge thing that we need to do to change. And also, there's admitting past sexual experience into the trial, which obviously is ridiculous, but is very often still done. So if you come across like a slut, then probably you wanted it. There are so many things that we need to change within the criminal justice system in the UK. That's definitely there. I don't know how it really works here. And your second question was, you know, internationally, how's it going, I suppose? Like, what effect has been had? This is only the second country apart from the UK that I've performed. I've toured around the UK. I did one performance in Dhaka in Bangladesh a year and a half ago. And that was, you know, it went down well. We had an open conversation. It was very interesting because there were all sorts of... there was one particular response or comment from the audience, which I remember very clearly, which was a guy saying, you know, when I come to this mirror towards the end and I hold it and it's a woman speaking about being in a relationship and being constantly pressured, this coercion culture that I was mentioning, constantly pressured into sex by her partner. And he was like, but hang on a minute, you're suggesting that within a relationship you can have rape. What are you talking about? You know? So that was something which I hope we began to at least unpick slightly. But I haven't yet been to any other countries with the play. I'm always trying to. We're trying to plan a tour in Zimbabwe next year, where we would also aim to create a legacy project in local languages. And it's something I've talked about and thought about here as well. And there have been questions also around the fact that, you know, they're all English, well, English, American, New Zealand, actually. But, you know, then aren't any local voices in this piece. And that's something which I had wanted to try and address, but it was actually impossible technically for us to do that. So what I've thought about doing is creating legacy projects. So, for example, in Zimbabwe, what we want to do is do performances of the show and then work with local women's rights organisations and find testimony from local survivors in local languages and then work with local actors in local languages to create a piece with their stories and their voices and their languages, which can then tour and be understood more widely. So I sincerely hope that I will be able to kind of, you know, keep rippling on with this piece because, yes, as you state in the first place, it began that I did the play and then it seemed like, oh, we actually need a space to discuss this afterwards, and that's why I held the panels. But now my own feeling is very much that I'm doing the play in order to have the conversation. And this feels like the most important thing. The play enables this, enables the conversation, because I feel like, as I said in the beginning, really, we need to destigmatize this conversation. It's only when we can have this conversation openly and publicly and frequently that we have any hope of change.
So the play in that case would only be the prelude, whereas yes, this becomes the performance.
Yes.
When you're actually able to get stories out from the audience and when the audience become the performers.
Yeah, and it's not that I ever attempt to bring stories out from the audience. It's not that
you might see that people are willing to offer their stories.
And sometimes people have asked questions about, you know, if there was a girl who had told her parents about something that they knew had done to her and they had told her to keep quiet, what would you say to her, kind of thing. So it was a bit third personed, but you know, sometimes there are those sharings, but it's not necessarily that I think, you know, people need to share their experiences, but just that we can talk about it, you know, just that we can say these words and have this conversation and maybe kind of begin to turn some cogs for people. Anyone else? Any other? Up there. Yes, hi.
I'm a master's student, and so I'm Samuel Fender.
Yeah.
And one of the conversations, especially since Johannesburg, I would like for us to have is the threat of sexual violence and how it sort of pervades, especially the younger years of a woman's education, how it sort of prevents them from achieving the fullest of their education because they have curfews and even some hostels are not allowed to go out into the market unless accompanied by a teacher, and they have certain end times, they need to have a local guardian, and there's not just the official but sort of social customs that they have to follow. So maybe five of you would like to comment, because that's so early, since such an early age, it seems like it's the woman's life who has to be, which has to be restricted. And then all the time we're told that if we don't do this, then it's something that goes against your own good. You should be on the same page as us because we're doing school. Yeah. So what is the responsibility of different stakeholders, such as teachers, such as perhaps also artists, because most universities also have a very vibrant performing arts department, as does ours, and sort of, I was wondering if
we have a conversation about that. That brings me back to my own college days and some of the incidences that I forgot to mention that actually led to my behavior with men, you know, my repulsion towards intimacy with men, is traveling in the local buses in Delhi, if you are aware of, you know, that region of India. The main reason why I had that repulsion towards men is because my first interaction with men, I was in a nuclear family, my sibling is a female, so, I mean, I had cousins, etc. So my one big, and, you know, grew up in a very protective sort of a culture. My first interaction, bigger interaction, was when I had to step out of the school and go to the university. I was staying in the NCR area of North India, and I had to go to Delhi and travel on a daily basis in one of those horrendous, take one of those horrendous bus rides. And I mean, now the situation is worse. This is like 15 years ago. And invariably in all the bus rides I would see that people were waiting. That was my perception of things. I knew that the moment I enter into the bus there'll be some male waiting to, you know, grab me in some on some body part of mine, and there were horrendous things like that. And then, you know, by practical wisdom, people told me how I can avert that. You know, I can ask whether there is a lady's seat. You know, there are seats reserved for ladies, and there are compartments reserved for ladies because of this.
But it's not like
culture.
Half the bus, is it?
Yeah.
It's like four seats.
Yeah,
so
four
what
seats.
If more
so the rest of them are, you know, exposed to the risk.
Yeah.
So I've been really exposed to the risk, and that is something that had, you know, a major mark on my psyche. But there were, I went to JNU, and later on I got the hostel, so I had to travel only once in the week. But it had, I don't know, I mean, it had a certain culture which allowed women to be out on the streets till like late in the night. And then I had these other male friends who would at instances, I mean, I had this male friend who was completely part of a, you know, part of a very, very patriarchal family. But when we would be riding in the bus, he would see to it, you know, that there were, that I wasn't too close to other men or things like that. So I had these, you know, small tactical ways of dealing with the thing on day-to-day basis. This is how I lived through it. Fortunately, after completing my master's, I got an opportunity to be away from India. And I thought that that was a cool breeze and I could do whatever I feel like. Misconception. Because it was, yeah, in a way, liberating. But then I understood that places are not very different from India. There are other, you know, other kinds of issues. But definitely I didn't have to go through that trauma, that day-to-day, you know, trauma of being touched by men all along.
Mm.
So that is one of the suggestions that I would have for you, that you can perhaps move around in a group with a few male friends, if that is possible, and explore those options.
And, you know, I think, you know, that's it's great to have that advice. But also, at the same time, there's a part of me which is going, but you shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to move around in groups. You shouldn't have to move around with guys. You should be able to, you know. And and also, even, you shouldn't have to go to... Because I'm like, yeah, just kick them in the balls. But you shouldn't have to go to self-defense classes in order to protect yourself.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Actually, my view is that the role of the teacher, the responsibility of the teacher in an educational situation, and the role of parents as well... We spend lots of time educating our little girls not to go out wearing this, not to go out too late, not to go here, not to do that, behave nicely, say no, whatever, whatever, whatever. We do not, and I'm talking very globally here, I don't have children myself, but we do not educate our boys to respect touch, to respect bodies, to respect no, to respect desire of another person. And I think, you know, teachers have to do that, parents have to do that. I've seen brilliant footage of some consent education that's going on in the States, I think it was, of, you know, preschool children. And people go all horror about that because, oh, you can't talk about sex with four-year-olds. No, you can't. Of course you can't. But you can talk about touch. And you can talk about what feels okay in your body. And does that, you know, would you... So they do this exercise where they're all sitting in a circle and they've got a doll, like a toy or something. And they go to every child and they've talked already about... feelings and where they sit in the body and when you know when it's a nice feeling and when you know when it's an icky feeling, when you know when you want something and when you know when you don't want something. Literally just like hugs. And they've got this toy and they take it to each child and they go, would you like a cuddle? And some of the kids go, yes! And they hug it. And then they talk about where did they feel that in their body. And then they go to another child and some of the children say, no, I don't. And they go, okay, that's fine too. And where did you feel that in your body? So we become aware of what we want and what we don't want in ourselves. But then also... that begins to educate them about going, you know, do you want to cuddle? No, you don't. Okay, fine. I know how that feels in myself. I know how it must feel in you. I'm not going to cross that boundary. So we need to educate from a very early age about responsibility not to cross those boundaries. If it's not your body, you don't get to say what happens to it. We only get to say what happens to our own bodies. And that's not going to help you because you're, you know, at this stage of your educational career. But maybe that, you know, we can hope will trickle down.
And when you were talking about, you know, why I was thinking about the self-defense class as another suggestion. But then you're right. I mean, why think of that? But that would, you know, then call our attention towards a more, towards a bigger structural change, you know, and some sort of a collective voice to come forward, particularly with the curfewing at the hostels. you know, that has been a major issue in many of the universities, and many students have been up out there protesting. Many girl students have been protesting to remove, to have that curfew removed. And I have seen many universities operating without the curfew and operating fine. So that would call for a structural change within the system.
Yeah.
So and an effort in that direction.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
That's another option.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I think we need to draw it to a close. Thank you very much for being here, and for all of you for being here as well. A couple of things I'll say before we actually finish. One is that, you know, obviously this has contained some strong material, and it can bubble up for people after the event, after having seen it. So I would say, you know, it could be tonight, it could be in the next couple of days even, that just have an awareness for yourself, just be sensitive to yourself, and if anything does come up for you, check in with yourself about what you need. What do you need to do in response to that? It might be that you need to talk to someone trusted. It might be that you need to just be completely on your own, or, you know, eat some really good food, sleep really well, have a bath, have a massage, something like that. Like, really take care of yourselves in these coming days if anything does come up for you. The other thing I would say is, Gwyn here, there, wave, thank you, that's Gwyn. We're kind of filming some of the, you know, as I said, the panels and conversations, and if anybody has anything they would like to share or say about the play, anything they haven't had a chance to say here, or any responses to the play, then it'd be really wonderful if you could find him, I think maybe in here, because it's going to be dark outside, isn't it? Can you, here, and we can stay, can we stay in here for a few minutes? So Gwyn will be in here, and if anybody has anything that they would like to share, any marvellous things they would like to say about this evening, that would really help us in taking this forward and changing laws all across the world. Thank you so much to Adi Shakti for having me here. Thank you very much to you. Have a great rest of your evening. Thank you.
And thank you. Thanks so much.